The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric Beck with you. This evening, we're sitting here at Fort Wayne, Indiana, actually doing a review class for Parkview. Up here, I'm with my good buddy, Bruce Hoffman. How you doing, dude?
Doing well.
So, we're going to do a podcast on a kind of a hot topic, more of a hot topic as it relates to toxicity, ingestion. And this topic is actually brought to my attention by a buddy of mine back home, Carl Binion. So I want to give a shout out to him for just asking us to go over this topic. He had a call last week and just wanted us to hit on all the high points of treatment and physiology related to this terrible type of an overdose. So we're going to go over a case and then break it down from the perspective of standard labs that you may see, an ABG. The physiology behind how it breaks down in the body, the metabolites that end up from the overall Tylenol. And then we're going to go through the four phases of the ingestion process and how that progresses. We'll look at the overall toxic dose ranges and then look at the treatments. And so try to, you know, do this over 35 to 45 minutes and wrap this up. So why don't you start us off, Bruce, with the beginning aspects of the case, and then we'll kind of build on that.
Sure thing. So this case is about a 19-year-old female patient who ingested approximately 20 500 milligram tablets of extra strength Tylenol. This was done about 20 minutes before EMS was activated and arrived on the scene. When they did, they found this patient sleepy, responsive to verbal stimuli, gave her a GCS of 14. This patient has no significant medical history, and takes no prescribed medications, and is not allergic to any drugs. Patient was given essentially just routine ALS treatment and brought to a local hospital.
Okay, cool. So a few things that jump out to me. Number one, when you talk about 20 500 milligram tablets, that's a 10 gram dose. So we'll hit on the lethal toxic dose ranges. The other aspect that I want to touch on is the patient's already sleepy. So 19-year-old female, she's already sleepy. This has only been 20 minutes after ingestion. So was there any concern or any differentials done? Did she take any other recreational medications? Was there any benzos or any Xanax, anything that would depress her that she'd already be showing clinical signs of that decompensation? 20 minutes seems pretty rapid. I guess everybody's a little different. It would all depend on how much she has eaten and her size, obviously. So what were you guys' thoughts?
She was a relatively small woman. We estimated approximately 75 kilos. The patient gave no indication, nor did her family really support anything that would make us concerned that she had taken any kind of recreational drugs whatsoever. The patient was very forthcoming about what she had done. We had the bottle of Tylenol there with us, and the family supported and corroborated the story that she was providing.
One of the things I want to point out is if you think about this dose and we calculate her, 20 pills at 500 milligrams apiece, that's a 10-gram dose. So let's hit on what those lethal dose ranges are for both adult and pediatric, and then we'll go into more of the labs on her.
So typical toxic doses for an adult patient would be around 7.5 grams per day. Would give you Tylenol toxicity in an adult. And for the child or for the pediatric, we talk about 150 milligrams per kilo per day as being toxic. So 7.5 grams per day for the adult, 150 milligrams per kilo per day for the pediatric would be those toxic ranges.
So when you consider a 7.5 gram, single dose, and it's really more of a single dose, one big bam, that's 15 tablets at 500 milligrams. So, definitely she has exceeded that. And
sure thing.
And what did we calculate her weight at? Was it right around 70, 75 kilos?
Yeah, so we guesstimated her weight at approximately 75 kilos.
Okay, awesome. So let's go through the labs. The initial Chem-7 came back, and so she has a sodium of 138, chloride of 102. We have a current K of 4.9, a BUN of 30, creatinine of 1.4. She's got a glucose of 126 and a serum Oz of 295. Lactate of 2.8. So based on that, is there anything that kind of sticks out that you are concerned about or are things fairly normal?
So I when I first looked at the lab work and evaluated the panel, a sodium of 138, the potassium of 4.9, the chloride of 102, the BUN of 30, the glucose of 126, those all to me didn't really stand out. There was nothing there that made me, kind of change my pattern of thinking. The two things that I really want to touch on, one, the creatinine of 1.4, in a suspected healthy 19-year-old female, creatinine 1.4 is on the higher side of normal, but that may be due to a number of factors, dehydration, and things like that. The other one that I want to talk about is the serum Oz, which is 295. That's on the high side of normal, but it is still normal. So there was no suspected issues looking at her serum Oz and combining that with the creatinine. We anticipated that she may just be a little bit on the dry side. So fluid was definitely one of the interventions that we'd be looking at in terms of those lab work. The lactate of 2.8, I think, is interesting. It always generates good conversation. When I first, was in a paramedic school and a new practicing paramedic, I was taught that lactate is a byproduct of anaerobic metabolism. And what we know now through, some educational experience and clinical experience is that lactate is really a byproduct of both aerobic and anaerobic metabolism. And where we would expect it to be a little bit high are in those patients that are undergoing some kind of stress response. That's where you typically see an elevated lactate, and that would become important. So, out of all of these labs, I wouldn't really, looking at them individually, there's nothing that really stands out that's going to dramatically change the course that we're headed down right now.
Okay, yeah, and to expand on that, I think you're spot on the lactate. We have really grown in our understanding of lactate, and just have to understand that lactate really, in a lot of people's eyes, doesn't really tell us anything, and I'm starting to really agree with that it's simply a marker of stress, and you should expect that. When we look at her sodium and chloride, remember, the sodium and chloride are strong acids. Those are considered very important to acid-base balance, and so we always look at the sodium chloride and we make that subtraction with a normal sodium of 140 and normal chloride of 102. And what we're utilizing there is not a range, we're using perfect numbers. And that difference is called the strong ion difference. So using what's called the Stewart model, we can extrapolate that, and that'll be another complete podcast that I'll probably be doing with Tyler Cristofoli on. But we always want to make that subtraction, and that difference is called the SID. And if we did this quick subtraction, 138 for a sodium and a 102 for a chloride, her SID is 36. The lower that number becomes, the more acidotic this patient is. And so just based on this right that now, a SID of 36, we're only a couple points off. That's not that big of a deal. Serum Oz, you talked about that. Is there a really easy way to remember what our serum Oz range is that you could share with us?
Yeah, sure thing. So if you were to look at the range of normal sodium being 135 to 145 milliequivalents, you can take an average of 140. If you just simply double that normal sodium value, you come out with 280. And that gives you really a pretty perfect serum Oz number. So, you know, the range of 295, 280 to 295, she's really not dramatically out of range for that value either.
Okay. When we continue and we look at her gap. So an anon gap is something that we can do in transport. We can calculate an anon gap by looking at their chloride and adding that to their, it's actually bicarb on the in the textbook, you know, formula, but it's actually the CO2 on a Chem 7. So
yep.
Chloride plus the CO2, and then you're going to take that answer and you're going to subtract it from the current sodium. And if we do a corrected anion gap, we would add our potassium onto it. So Bruce and I have already done this, and we come out with a gap of 34. Now, anything greater than, you know, every hospital is a little different. Some hospitals may not have a range. They may say an uncorrected gap without the sodium factored in, anything greater than 12 is significant. And then if you actually factor in the potassium, anything greater than 16 for most hospitals, you know, we kind of see on the exams more of a range of 16 to 20. And sure, I always think, you know, if I'm greater than 20 on a gap that's corrected, you know, that's significant. And so we're at a 34. So there's some, you know, red flags. Whenever we see a big gap like this, that is significant. And I'll expand on that when we kind of calculate and look at this ABG. So let's hit on that ABG. We have an ABG, currently pH is 7.17. We have a PaCO2 of 18. We have a bicarb of 7. And we have a PaO2 of 104. So what are your initial thoughts on that?
Just going back for a minute and looking at the anion gap, I think that you know, her gap of 34 is significant and points directly to some kind of acidotic state. And this is really corroborated by the blood gas that we have here. So the pH being 7.17, if we follow kind of the first name, middle name, last name model of identifying a blood gas, just by looking at our pH, we can determine whether there is compensation or not and whether this is an alkalosis or an acidosis. So starting with 7.17, that would be, initially we would say that that falls outside the range of normal, so this would be initially uncompensated, but we'll have to look at a couple parameters as we go forward. And then 7.17 is an acidosis, so we have so far an uncompensated acidosis.
Perfect, yes.
Looking at the CO2 being low, you know, we can't totally throw that value out. That's an important value as we go forward in determining what the blood gas is, but we're going to hold on to that. We know that that's low. Normal range is 35 to 45. And then the bicarb of 7 really becomes the key player here. And that bicarb being 7 is significantly low, and I think that's contributing to, you know, the acidotic state. So by putting, you know, forward both the first name, middle name, and last name, you have an uncompensated metabolic acidosis. However, when you go back and look at the CO2 and realize that it's 18, that's a low value. We typically see a high CO2 related to a respiratory acidosis. But in this case, low CO2 is actually trying to compensate for the extreme metabolic acidosis. So that really turns this into a partially compensated metabolic acidosis.
Yeah, that, and I think that's a perfect example and explanation. We have to always consider, and when we teach our review classes, if you've taken our classes, you know that I really, really, really go over that aspect constantly. You know, we hit on this throughout the entire review class, and we have different cases that utilize that methodology and that actual concept, because that is one of the silent lethal killers. If we can't identify very rapidly a partially compensated metabolic acidosis, we can make the wrong decision. So that's very, very important.
Sure thing.
A few things that stick out to me. Number one, an anion gap, high anion gap like this, that's a red flag. There's a few types of metabolic acidosis that stick out that cause a high gap. Obviously, Tylenol toxicity like this, metformin-induced metabolic acidosis
sure
will cause this.
Yep.
You know, those two specifically, you'll see high gaps in DKA. But, you know, those are the three right off the top of my head that really stick out. Now, you couple this with a bicarb of 7. Bicarbs, when you see a bicarb, guys, of less than 10, man, red flags all over. Ingestion, because you should not see a bicarb that low. You'll see that in that metformin-induced metabolic acidosis. You'll see that in this. And that is very, very significant. Our CO2 of 18, that's telling you that there's respiratory compensation, meaning that if we consider our buffering systems, we have our carbonic that's playing behind the scenes, little workers metabolizing all the CO2. And we have to understand that in normal physiology, we actually build 300 liters of CO2 every single day that our body has to metabolize and get rid of. CO2 is an acid. We also have this huge amount of hydrogen that has to be, you know, absorbed and gained. And we know oxygen is a big player there. The point being is that we have a CO2 of 18. And if you remember from the Metabolic Acidosis Rodeo podcast, we talked about a formula that will help you calculate total respiratory compensation, essentially telling you what's the maximum respiratory compensation you can have. And that formula is going to be 1.5 times the bicarb and then plus 8. So 1.5 times the bicarb will be in parentheses, plus 8 will be there at the end. And if we did that based on their overall numbers, this young lady's numbers, total compensation is going to be right around 19.5. So PaCO2 is 18. We're a little bit lower than that, but we have to understand that that CO2 is a reflection of other things. And so we have an actual patient that has now an end-tidal CO2 nasal cannula, and we're getting end-tidal CO2s of 16. We have a current blood pressure of 86 over 32 and a pulse of 130. So that allows us to look at that end-tidal and look at that CO2 and say, okay, well, you know, that PaCO2 is 18. We're right there, maximum, obviously, respiratory-wise. The end-tidal, remember, is always going to be the lowest number out of those two. It can never be higher, so it's always going to be lower, and it's 16. Now, why is it so low? Well, you know, she has a potential perfusion issue. Blood pressure is lower. Pulse rate is high, so she's obviously in that decompensation stage at this point. So when we look at the blood pressure, you know, the blood pressure, and we get so enamored by blood pressure, we have to lose that mindset, and it's more important to look at a map. What is the map? Mean arterial pressure, and I think, Bruce, you had calculated that out.
So with that blood pressure, her map would come out to be 50 millimeters of mercury, which is low, and she's definitely in that decompensated stage like you mentioned.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, this kid is sick. So where do we go from here? We've identified labs. We've got that initial baseline. We've got a lactate that's normal. We're not going to really worry about that at this point. We have a gap that's high. We have an ABG that's showing that partial compensation, so partially compensated metabolic acidosis. We've identified she's in maximum respiratory compensation at this time. She does have a perfusion-related problem now, and her MAP is 50, so we're going to have to address that. Let's move on and look at, you know, that physiology. I do want to refer everybody back. If you haven't listened to the podcast that we did on, you know, the aspects of plasma protein binding, how medications move in the body, how they work in the body, I highly recommend you go back and listen to that, because we have two types of metabolisms. And that means how do medications break down in the body? Whether they're given IV, sublingual, IM, that's going to go through a systemic circulation first. It's going to be able to hit the receptors, and it's going to go through second pass metabolism. If we put something in our mouth and swallow it and go down through our intestines, it absorbs through that intestinal wall, and it actually goes through the hepatic, you know, circulation and into the liver, and it goes through first pass metabolism. So that's why any dosages that we give PO always have to be greater, because you usually lose about 50% of that medication through that process.
Sure thing.
So how does that whole metabolism change with somebody that has taken a dose that size? You know, how is that going to break down? What's the component? And that's what I want to really get to, is what metabolites end up hurting our patients that ingest Tylenol. Why is it such a bad, medication?
So I think one of the things that we can talk about is looking at kind of breaking Tylenol down. The metabolite that we're most concerned about is oxaproline, and that's really the metabolite that we're going after and that we really need to stifle in order to bring this patient to a full recovery.
Now, if you guys remember, we did that podcast, the three-part series on acidosis rodeo, and we went through the mnemonic Goldmark. Goldmark replaced, in many, many physicians' eyes, the old, archaic, long cat mud piles. And if we go through that really rapidly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. Remember, G is glycols. We're talking about ethylene glycol, propylene glycol. O is oxaproline. That is the metabolite of Tylenol. And, you know, that's what's hurting this patient is that little
specific metabolite.
Yeah. Yep. Remember, L is L-lactate, so the standard lactate production that we've seen in glycolysis. D is going to be D-lactate. That's a byproduct of short bowel syndrome and a bacterial etiology that produces that type of lactate. So providers have to specifically clue in on that type of presentation and actually have that lab measured. And then we go through MARC. MARC is going to be methanol. So think of any methanol derivative, not antifreeze, but your overall windshield wiper fluid, de-icer, you know, different solvents will have methanol. And then A is going to be aspirin overdose.
Mm-hmm.
R is going to be renal failure. And K is going to be ketones or ketoacidosis. So that's DKA, starvation, or R, alcoholic. You know, if we expand on this and talk about the whole metabolite thing, we have to understand that any high anion gap metabolic acidosis from the, you know, buildup of that oxaproline related to acetaminophen toxicity, we can actually have patients that are predisposed to have worse presentations based on, you know, do they have good PO intake? So are they malnourished?
Sure thing.
Is she pregnant? Somebody that doesn't eat meat, that's a vegetarian, are they currently septic? Do they have any bacterial septicemias? Do they have any chronic renal insufficiencies or renal failures? Do they have liver failures, right? Hepatitis C, hepatitis in any form. So all of those, chronic alcohol use, all of those different past medical history problems put them at a higher disposition to respond negatively to Tylenol toxicity. So, you know, we have to get a good overall history. It sounds like you guys did that, and she didn't have really any history. 19 years old, probably somebody that goes out and, you know, lives it up a little bit like many do. So definitely could have those aspects.
Yeah, when, you know, those would be good things to rule out, you know, in terms of pertinent negatives, and there were none that she, you know, none that she was positive for. So I think what's kind of important to kind of add into the conversation, so oxaproline is also known as pyroglutamic acid, and this is kind of one of those metabolites that really causes some pretty serious problems. We know that this kind of organic acid, the oxaproline, is really kind of a rare presentation of metabolic acidosis, but it's a certainly lethal presentation with metabolic acidosis. So I think that plays an imperative role in this case.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, you know, using that Goldmark mnemonic doesn't mean that we as critical care providers or, you know, pre-hospital providers can correct these things. But I think the more we know, the more we understand, the more that we have in our tool bag. That's what I always say, is bring your knowledge to the highest level possible, and ultimately it's going to allow you to understand your patients better. You'll be better apt to make good clinical decisions. You're more proactive and confident in your decision makings overall. So based on that, let's move on to the different phases. As we said in the very beginning, that is a big, big part of these tests, is understanding the phases, and that gets people all upset. I remember initially taking the FPC, and this was something that I remember focusing on because, you know, you're talking about different phases, and you have hour requirements, and you have all the different clinical signs, and that can get very, very overwhelming. So why don't we hit on those phases, and really quickly hit the phases, and then let's talk about each one.
Sure thing.
So phase one. Phase one we know is from basically ingestion up to 24 hours. So what can we see in that first phase?
So typically the patient, most patients I would say are asymptomatic, but typically it's flu-like symptoms. So they're, you know, they might be a little lethargic, they might be a little sleepy, you know, maybe a little bit, you know, of nausea, maybe some intermittent vomiting, but the symptoms really aren't, you know, aren't anything glorious. They're nothing, you know, super significant. But phase one, like you said, can really last from kind of that, you know, up to a half hour after ingestion up to that 24-hour mark. Some patients don't even make it all the way through phase one in terms of that 24-hour mark. Some start even a little bit early into phase two, which can set in at about 18 hours. And that's where you see a patient becoming more symptomatic. So for, you know, from phase one into phase two is typically 18 to 72 hours. This is where you can start to see a raise or rise in their, you know, serum transaminase. You can see their AST and ALT start to climb a little bit as those hepatocytes are destroyed. And as those, you know, kind of functional, you know, liver components start to become damaged, the patient's going to present with that kind of classic right upper quadrant pain. The other thing that you can see in phase two, which is really kind of that precursory phase to when, you know, the whole body starts to kind of shut down in phase three, is that you'll start to see the patient's total urine output start to drop. And we refer to that as oliguria. And the primary cause of this reduction in urine output is due to what we'd call acute tubular necrosis. So that is a direct kidney injury, and that's causing her low urine output, which is another classic component of phase two.
Yeah, and so when we look at her presentation, you know, one of the things that you found out that her ingestion actually wasn't 20 minutes.
Correct.
That it was well before what they thought.
Exactly, you know? Right. So initially when we presented the case, you know, they had told us that it was about 20 minutes, but come to find out based on her presentation and then later drawing levels and things like that, we determined that it was a significantly longer period of time. You know, from the time that she had ingested, from the time that we had arrived on the scene and got her transported off to the hospital.
Yeah, so you actually said something really profound, and this is a very common question that we get is, you have phase one is from 0 to 24 hours, and phase two is from 18 to 72 hours, and I get that question all the time. They're like, well, why is phase two? That number has to be incorrect, and it's because there's some bleed back, right?
You sure
have
thing.
You have that bleed back, and I think you illustrated that very, very well. So we have phase one, we have phase two, and then phase three is from 72 hours to 96 hours. And this is where all the bad stuff happens. This is where you're going to get tested on. You're going to be asked these questions. And honestly, if I'm not mistaken, if you can get the patient through this stage, they're usually home free. But this is the area that they either make it or they die.
Yep,
is that
this
correct?
This is the make it or break it phase. And like you mentioned, this is classic from 72 hours out to 96 hours. The patient here presents with kind of a variety of symptoms. You know, primarily you still have your nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal distension, abdominal pain. But there's two things that we really need to throw in here during phase three, and that is one, disseminated intravascular coagulation. We know that the liver is really the synthesizing organ of vitamin K, so it plays a vital role in clotting. And then we also know that the liver hosts and stores glycogen stores, and those are really stimulated by beta receptors, as we mentioned earlier. So two things that you can really expect to see in this phase is a patient, you know, who goes into full-blown DIC, and then a patient who is burning through their glycogen stores. And some of that is partially the stress response, but also kind of how it interacts with the beta receptors on those glycogen stores. And conversion to glucose. So DIC and then that hypoglycemic event. One of the things that I think is important to mention here is that if a patient's going to die from Tylenol toxicity, it is during phase three. It's during phase three. This is kind of when the entire body starts to shut down. So a couple things that triggers the eventual collapse of a patient can be from cerebral edema, sepsis, or kind of that all-encompassing multiple organ dysfunction syndrome. Those are really the three that propagate a fatality during this specific phase of phase three.
Yeah, no, I think those are great points. And, you know, I think we do have to point out that even though phase three is that critical stage, you know, the data shows that very, very low percentage in overall death. So 4%, less than 4% actually die of acetaminophen toxicity. You see more, you know, severe liver involvement as far as jaundice, and you have that, you know, enlargement, that tenderness around the liver. They'll have definitely the DIC, the clotting issues, and internal bleeding. And so, you know, they have those secondary issues, the acute tumor necrosis, the renal failure from that. And obviously, you know, based on different levels, you know, could they have long-term effects? You know, I guess that definitely is possible.
Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting here is that you know, we talk about, you know, and we had just mentioned, you know, the metabolites being some of the most lethal but most rare metabolites to cause kind of these severe cases of metabolic acidosis. But, you know, if the patient is able to survive phase three, they march right on to phase four. And phase four can come as early as day number four from this Tylenol toxicity, right up to 3 weeks. And that typically is how long it takes for that liver to fully recover. And it does so by a couple of key treatments that the patient would receive typically in the in-hospital setting.
So before we touch on the core treatment, is there are certain Tylenol levels based on, you know, ingestion time frame that we focus on in the hospital setting as far as then treating with antidotes?
So I think when we would start therapy inside the hospital for Tylenol toxicity, there's a couple things that we need to remember. And these are a couple different levels. So if after essentially, you know, you check your Tylenol level after 4 hours of ingestion, if it's over 140 micrograms per ml, that would be a reason to treat. Now, we've talked about, you know, at the four-hour mark. Let's march it out to 8 hours. If at the eight-hour mark they were to draw repeat, lab values, specifically AST and ALT, and Tylenol levels, if the Tylenol level was over 70, you know, mics per ml at the eight-hour mark, you would also treat, this patient. And then really any time you see the AST and ALT elevated, that's really a good time to treat that person with an antidote. So those would be the three really specific levels that upon which you would give the antidote.
Okay, and so what is the main antidote? Let's talk about that.
Yep. So the main antidote is something called N-acetylcysteine. Or a mucamist. You might also hear it called acetidote. And this is a very popular drug, not very frequently carried in the pre-hospital setting, but certainly in the intra-hospital environment, readily available, and definitely be able to transport with the drug. So a couple things about, I think, mucamist or acetylcysteine. The one thing that always stands out if people have ever given the drug or, you know, been around the drug is that it has a significant odor to it. It typically smells like rotten eggs. So it's a pretty horrible smelling drug. What's interesting about acetylcysteine is it's a modified form of cysteine. And cysteine is nothing more than an amino acid or built up by all those protein bodies. And it is essential for liver function that cysteine be available. And so acetylcysteine being kind of a modified variant of that protein becomes, you know, the primary antidote. One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, if you look at how acetylcysteine works, it's really to reestablish the presence of something called glutathione. And glutathione is essential to prevent further damage or cellular injury to the liver. And so, you know, we can give acetylcysteine, and it's a truly effective antidote if given at the appropriate time to really restore that liver to full function and prevent further collapse.
Well, I think those are all great points. And, you know, obviously, pre-hospitally, you're not going to have a mucomist. But you definitely could transfer somebody. You could have transfer somebody that had just been given mucomist. And so, you know, pre-hospitally, if you're maybe a ground-based paramedic that's working, you know, in a different environments, whether that's rural or maybe you're in the urban environment, right? Different transport times, and so you may have more time to do specific things. But I think the key things is, number one, if you know ingestion happened in the last 3 or 4 hours, then you definitely could go the activated charcoal route if you carry that. I definitely would put an NG or G-tube down and try to establish that and get that. If the patient is depressed and mentation is down, again, that's where you have to think about clinical course and utilize your protocols. And, you know, if you have the ability to place an advanced airway, you know, if she's going to keep declining and there's any risk that she can't protect her airway, can she follow your commands? Can she control her secretions? Those are the key assessment tools we use. We don't do GCS less than 8 innovate. We utilize good assessment skills, and we evaluate and make good clinical decisions based on those criteria. And, you know, fluid volume status. Make sure she's got a couple large bore IVs. She definitely has a perfusion-related issue.
Sure thing.
You know, make sure you're thinking about that. We're not saying to dump 2, 3, 4 liters of fluid in, but just make sure that her tank is full, and then just manage her airway and get her to a facility. I would always, especially with any acetaminophen toxicity, make sure you check a blood sugar.
Sure thing.
And then go based off of that, treat based on that. But I think the key thing is to get her to a facility that can manage. If this is, again, in the pre-hospital environment that is just a normal 911 call, and this is not a transfer, then you have to start that care and be that detective and try to get as much information as possible. And then, you know, if this is more of a transfer setting, then you're going to have maybe a different set of thoughts. And, you know, remember, this is a flight cruise, you may go to these small hospitals that are maybe behind the times. Maybe they haven't even started mucomist. Maybe they haven't done some of the lab tests. And depending on your level of, you know, need to intervene, maybe the patient needs to have something started before you leave. Maybe you decide to just get the patient out. You know, that's going to be your determination. But ultimately, I think this case really highlights that it's important. The information that you're given may not be correct. You guys initially thought this ingestion was pretty rapid, and it ended up being, you know, over an entire day, and that's why you were starting to see the clinical signs later on, you know. And I think that highlights that we have to be very objective, and we have to be open-minded, and you just take things for that, and then just build on that and try to gain perspective with everybody involved, and then, you know, get the patient to a facility that can manage her. You know, and I think we highlighted all the main points. I don't know if there's anything you think we missed. You know, feel free to jump in. But I think this is, you know, this is a topic that we need to understand, that we have to be able to intervene on. And, you know, it's not going to be very common for us to find a patient in phase three.
Absolutely.
You know, we're talking 3 to 4 days, right?
Yeah.
But we definitely could transfer somebody, and that's the thing.
Absolutely.
You know, that's where we're going to see patients at that level.
Sure thing. Yeah, I think just some sage advice that was given to me back when I first started practicing is that, you know, with specific toxidromes like Tylenol toxicity, it is imperative that you get a solid baseline assessment up front. If your assessment and your clinical information is bad, that can lead you down an entirely different toxidrome path, and that's going to lead you to potentially giving the wrong antidote. So I think, you know, you kind of talked about playing detective and kind of playing, you know, medical detective to kind of get to the core of this patient's symptoms and clinical story to assure that we got her to the right place, you know, in the appropriate time and get her the treatment that she needed.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I mean, I think we really have hit this. I want to just thank you for taking the time out. We've been teaching all day, and it's now 10:30, and I think this is going to be a good podcast for people to just review. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to chowing through some cheesecake.
All right. Well, guys, hey, as always, if you have any great cases, feel free to email me or text me if you have my number, and we would love to hear your thoughts. If you haven't checked out the online university, check it out. I'm getting a lot of nice comments, so thank you for that. And again, remember, Fast 19 is scheduled, and we do have tickets on sale now at a discounted rate that will be ending here soon, and they won't ever be that price again. So take advantage of that, and again, reach out to me, and we appreciate everybody and all their support. So until next time, I will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.